Okay. Welcome to my favorite cheer of all time. These are ideas that I feel very close to because, as far as I know, most of them are my own. You will find that it's because a lot of it isn't even found in the Torah. You'll see what I mean. But also because this holiday is coming soon. Purim is something that is very close to my heart. Mainly because of how human it is. It's perhaps the most human of all holidays. As we know, what's unique about Purim is that the miracle that we acknowledge and celebrate is one that took place within the laws of nature, which means there is nothing you could point to that says there's something supernatural or something beyond, but it was specifically in our ability to see God's hand within our human existence that made this special. And what we're going to discuss is something very human, which is a little less typical, especially when it comes to holidays, when it comes to the times of the year that we dedicate to God, where we think of elements in our life like Kedusha, spirituality, holiness, where we tend to separate, which is what the word Kedusha means, from our normal lives, from our reality, from the mundane. And here it's actually the most mundane of the mundanes, the setting of Purim, that we find holiness. Before we continue, I want to point out that this shiur should be in the schus of us learning tonight. It should be a refuah for Rina Freida Devora Bas Esther Shoshana, who is a 10-year-old girl who happens to be my niece, who just had a surgery today, which is already over, so we don't have to worry anymore about how the surgery went, but hopefully that the recovery and the results and all the steps ahead for her are as they should be. So our learning should be in the schus of her refuah. So I consider Purim to be the most misunderstood day of the year in the Jewish calendar. It's most misunderstood because it seems so obvious of what it's supposed to be on the surface. We were in big trouble. We did tshuva. God saved us. Let's party. Like a lot. What is so complicated, right? And yet if you do the eye test on Purim, meaning you look at how Purim goes, it just doesn't seem to represent this amazingly spiritual, uplifting day. The options are everyone gets it wrong, or almost everyone, or we're getting it right and we don't know what we're doing. We don't know why we're getting it right, right? I can't seem to think of what other alternatives are, but even in the most sacred of places and yeshivas, and I'm not naming names, but you'll see scenes that will question, is this what we're after? Is this what we're going for? Is it to really try and push the limits of your tolerance for alcohol to the point where you don't even know if you're wearing clothes or what's coming out of your mouth? Is this where we're headed? You know, and that's, I'm mainly referring to the experiences as, let's say, in my previous life in yeshiva or as a single guy. But even so, I spent a bunch of years driving my kids through B'nai Brak to do Matanos Lev Yonim and to give Shalach Manos. And I had to do some difficult explaining to them of what we were looking at and why someone is spraying our car with silly string and trying to get in and why I need to lock the doors and what's going on here, right? I wish that was only hypothetical, but that was only 2 years ago. And what are we after here? And like I said, the answer is either this is it and there's not much more to it, or we're getting it all wrong. And there's something way deeper, way deeper. And I want to explore this idea of happiness. I wrote in the Facebook event, and the way I publicized it was, what's this concept of happiness that we're trying to go for, which seemingly that's what the partying is about. Seemingly that's what the wine is for. That's what the costumes, that's what the funny music, that's what the silliness. It's meant to foster this environment where more happiness can exist. And of course, we know from the famous Mishnah and Tanis that actually this happiness is supposed to start from the beginning of the month and maybe in some way climax in Purim or culminate in Purim in some way. Is this the happiness that we're going for? Party. Because I taught a lot of college-age students about right and wrong and teaching the way to live an uplifted life. And usually what I was talking about was to decide against this, to not express your happiness or search for happiness in partying. So what are we going for here, and how is this the scene of going overboard, leading us to happiness? Are we understanding what happiness really is? Furthermore, there's a famous Hasidic teaching, mystical teaching, that if you look closely at the word Yom Kippur, as it is written in the Torah, it is called Yom Kippurim. And if you do a little photoshopping of that word, you will find that in that word, it sounds a whole lot like Yom Kippurim, a day like Purim. And many Hasidic scholars want to say from that, that Purim is on such a high level of Kedusha, has so much spiritual energy balled up into this day, so much so that Yom Kippur is compared to it. That Yom Kippur is on, in some way, on a lower level of Kedusha, that it is associated with Purim being on a higher level of Kedusha. And this seems incredibly counterintuitive. How could it be that Yom Kippur, which the Torah calls Shabbat Shabbaton, which the Torah proclaims, the Torah written by God, that this is the holiest day of the year, there's no getting around that, halachically speaking, this is it, the highest of the high, the holiest of the holies, and yet a day that came hundreds of years later, instituted by the rabbis, is in some way on a higher level. What are we trying to say here? In fact, you could make a claim that Yom Kippur and Purim are polar opposites. Literally, if I would quiz you, name two holidays in the year, any two, that you would consider the opposite days. Maybe you'd go for Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, although they're fast days, I don't know. But Yom Kippur and Purim makes the most sense. One, you don't eat anything. Two, you literally have to eat and drink everything. Or the other one. One, you sit alone and quietly say words to yourself, literally the whole day. Two, you hug as many people as you can, stranger or best friend alike, running around town handing out food and singing, right? These are polar opposites. Not only is it hard for us to say that they're the one and two in some order of holiness, but how do they even have any relationship at all? So I wanna take one giant leap into the inner world of Purim through this lens of happiness, of what it means for a human being to find happiness. And through answering that question, Be'ezrat Hashem, we could open up a whole new perspective, a whole new approach to what it means to celebrate Purim. So how do we define happiness? The best way that I've found to define something that I have no idea how to define is to try and define its opposite. And if I could figure out what the opposite of that thing is, I could usually use that rule to define that thing. So let's take a stab at sadness. What is sadness? I'll accept answers from the floor. How would we define sadness? You could take one particular example in your mind and try and capture what it is that I am doing at that moment when I'm sad.
Crying.
What is the reason why I'm crying? On an elemental level. Yes.
I think a lot of times it stems from like a feeling of helplessness.
Uh-huh. That I'm not in control.
Yeah. I can't change the thing that I want to change.
Ah. Okay, that's where we're headed. I can't change the thing that I want to change. In my mind, it exists even on a more basic level than that. Meaning that's even more advanced on the level of what it is I'm sad about.
There's some loss.
There's a loss. For sure. Now, loss can have very different meanings. Obviously, loss very tangibly could be a pet, our keys, a person, God forbid. It could be a job. It could be even an opportunity. But if we look deeper beneath these different situations that we just discussed, I would say that the most basic understanding of what sadness is there is something that I want on the inside. I want it. And on the outside, I don't have it. There's a disconnect between what I want and what I have. And that means if I want someone in my life or something in my life and I don't have it, there's now a disconnect. I want my keys because I need to leave for work, and I don't have my keys, right? I want my pet. I want my job. I want to get into that school. All of these things. And because they're not in my life, and because I can't have them, there is a detachment, in a way, between what's happening in my reality, my outer world, and what I feel in my inner world. Would you guys agree with that definition? Good. So now this part should be easier. How do we define happiness?
There's something you want and you have it.
Simple, right? See how much easier that was?
It's a good trick.
It's a good trick. Happiness is simple. I want it, and I have it. Or in more sophisticated terms, my inner world and my outer world match. They're the same. There is no more disconnect between what's inside my desires and what has manifested itself in reality. So we struggle with this as people because by nature, we want lots of things. We desire things that we don't always have the ability to make sure happens. And then when that scenario plays itself out where we don't have it, there is that sadness creeping in again, right? It's no wonder, by the way, if you think of the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, of Perek Dalet Mishnah Aleph, Ezehu Bashir, who is someone who's rich? Not someone who has a lot of stuff. Because someone who has a lot of stuff might still want more stuff and not have it. What is the sign of someone who's rich? Someone who is happy with what he already has, or she. And that means their outer world and their inner world match. What I have is what I want. Interesting. Keep that in mind. I want to introduce you to a social psychologist named Irving Goffman. Have I told you this before?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But I don't remember.
Irving Goffman is a psychologist that I learned when I was in Yeshiva University. It was taught in the class of social psychology, and at the time I had no idea if this would have any bearing on my life whatsoever. I was taught by a very interesting professor who wore sandals in New York in January, which is not an easy thing to do. He was committed, and we had very interesting discussions about social theories and the way people behave, interact in their social lives. And one of the people I was introduced to in theories was this man named Irving Goffman. And he had this approach to how we behave called dramaturgy, or the dramaturgical perspective. And what he basically claims is the whole world is a stage, and we are but actors. That what we do throughout our lives is we constantly assess what kind of person I should be in any given environment, and then we construct a version of ourselves subconsciously. We're not thinking about this, we do this. And we present that version of ourselves in that environment in order to get the result, the outcome that we want, which is typically to have that person find us pleasing to them, right? To validate who we are, or to get what we want. The way that I like to think of it is, think of a job interview. What do we do at a job interview? We very carefully consider what we're going to wear, how we're going to look, how we're position is going to be when we're sitting, what our facial expression is going to be even when we're not talking, where I'm going to put my hands, like spread, pockets, right? We carefully consider how loud or quietly we laugh. We don't want to come off as weirdos. Everything we do, we say, is constructed purposely in order to achieve the outcome of they like me, they think I'm good enough to do the job, and they will give me an offer, right? Now, Goffman says we do this 24/7 without realizing it. When we're home, there is a version of ourself at home that exists among our siblings and our parents. There's a dynamic there that we construct, and we get used to that persona. And once we do that and we find a version of ourselves that works, we stick to it like a role. There's a version of ourselves in school. Have you ever had that friend that they're like the quiet kid in school and they're like, oh, come over to my house, and then you go over for a play date and they're like completely bonkers off the walls and they're like screaming and yelling and we're like, what did I just, who are you? I don't know you anymore, right? We know that friend. Maybe we were that friend. Who knows? That's simply another role that that person played. They fit into a certain dynamic. They assessed what version of myself works best in school and what version of myself works best at home. And we do this constantly for strangers. We do this quick, instant, hyper-assessment of who should I be right now? For acquaintances, for friends, for rabbis, for everyone. There is literally no situation where we are not a version of ourselves. Now, what's interesting about that is the result of that, what that means about who we are as people. What that means about who we are as people if he is correct, is that we are never us. There may not be even a clear idea of who we are, because we are simply the sum total of the versions of ourselves that we choose to be around everyone. That's us. So much so that it's not even so easy to pinpoint who is this that I'm looking at. Because I really only know myself in the way that other people know me, that the versions of myself. What that also means is that there's almost constantly at least a tiny detachment between who we really are and who we present ourselves as. Do you see how that works? There's always at least a slight modification of the real us in order to fit the situation that we're in. And since we are always in situations all day, we're constantly a slightly different version of us. And every time we do that, which, by the way, it's a good thing to do. You know who doesn't do that? Old people. They stop caring, right? So they're just going to say, you smell bad, and it's not going to matter to them what the social ramifications of saying that is, because you know, I'm done playing the game. I'm out, right? Bahama shirt. That's it. I checked out. But we have to constantly play this game of what role I need to play in order to get what I need to get. And that means we are perpetually slightly different than who we really are on the inside. The outside us is never truly the inside us. Keep that in mind. There's another interesting experience I had in my life. When I was in yeshiva, there was a sign that went up, an opportunity to be trained by an organization called Simchat HaLev. They do medical clowning, and they would give us a course on like 6 to 8 Fridays on what it means to be a clown. It wasn't clear to me that you need a training to be a clown, but you do. And then after we did our training, we would be carpooled to different hospitals in Israel and be clownish around kids, usually in the children's ward. It was fun, and I had recently learned to play guitar, so that was a bad bonus, and it was great. And one of the exercises that we did on one of those Fridays when I was learning how to become a clown will stay with me for a long time. As you can see, it has, because of how strange and uncomfortable it was. He put us all in a circle, this guy, and he said, okay, each of you turn either to the right or to your left so that you're facing the person next to you. And there's someone literally right here in front of you, and you're staring at them and they're staring at you. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to say an emotion, and for 30 straight seconds, you are going to express that emotion as extreme as possible directly into the face of the person in front of you. It was absolutely the most awkward thing I've ever done in my life. Never do this. So he would say, now again, any emotion, it's really hard, even in an authentic, real moment, to show it on your face for more than 4 seconds. Time yourself the next time you're really surprised how long it takes for your face to go back to normal. So he said, excited, go! And we just had to be like, just for 30 straight seconds, and forget the fact that we had to hold ourselves back from laughing. It was really hard, and then we had to do angry and just anger and just channel it through our face. And what... It was just bizarre. It was just so strange. And what was interesting was he was teaching us the lesson on what a clown is. What is a clown exactly? Think about it, besides the scary ones that we don't want to think about. A clown is, maybe I'll take the definition of this one. What seems to be is, the classic form of it is someone who greatly exaggerates many aspects of our human lives, which may explain the enlarged shoes, the major suspenders, the big hair. Instead of brown hair, it's orange hair, right? Everything is just blown out of proportion. It's just taken to the extreme, which is a classic form of comedy, exaggeration, right? But consider the emotional side of it. What does a clown do when it's walking around and then slips on a banana and falls? It gets up and does what? Right? And it just sits there and cries like a child. And we all laugh at the clown. Sometimes we point and laugh because the clown hurt himself and is crying alone on the floor. What do we regular human beings do when we mistakenly, let's say we're walking up the stairs and we skip one and we fall and almost, you know, completely spill all over the floor? I'll tell you what the typical male does. Probably tries to get up as quickly as possible and avoids acknowledging that that ever happened. Do you agree with that? There's usually an attempt to be like, well, it's all good. I was just checking the time, checking my shoelace. No big deal. Yeah, would you agree? Is there any other answer that I'm not thinking of? Maybe we could go back to someone who's like 17, where it really matters if they fall. We kind of lost our ego once, I don't know. You have enough like kids spilling food on you, then you're just like, what does it matter anymore? What is a... Again, we'll keep it in the teenage world where social rules matter a lot. What does a teenage girl do? It's something very different than a guy who tries to cover it up and act like nothing happened. A girl will do one thing at least 80% of the time in my understanding and experience in YouTube, which is laugh. Laugh hysterically. Now, what's going on there psychologically, if I may? What's going on there is, this is either really embarrassing and people will laugh at me, and I can't escape from that, or I could be in on the joke, and if I laugh along with everyone, then it's even funny to me, and I don't have to feel bad for myself, because even I agree with you that it's funny. I'm so clumsy. Both of those are an attempt to conceal what's really being felt on the inside, which is complete embarrassment and maybe even a little pain in your shin for tripping on a stair, right? It's, I either need to keep laughing even though I'm really hurt inside so that I don't feel bad, or I need to cover this up like this never happened so that I don't have to feel bad. What does a clown do, if we're going to go back to the clown part? Cries on the floor. So now we define the clown as someone who greatly exaggerates what it means to be human. And I want to argue, besides for the aesthetics of a clown, but emotionally speaking, a clown doesn't exaggerate at all. A clown actually does the opposite. A clown actually demonstrates what you're feeling on the inside very accurately in a way that we would never do because of how socially unacceptable we would find it to be. So we slip and fall on the floor and we cover it up, or we become part of the joke so that we don't have to feel what we're feeling inside or show what we're feeling inside. A clown will fall and show you exactly what they're feeling inside. And you know why that's funny? Because we would never do what we're actually feeling. That's preposterous. We would hide it every single time. And a clown is allowed to do that. and it exposes what's hilarious about the seemingly hypocrisy of how we feel, of how we behave, sorry. Now, a clown does that because they wear a mask. They wear makeup. The same guy, once they're off the job and walking home, if they fell getting to their car, they wouldn't be able to sit there and cry. We would laugh at them and they would be truly embarrassed. So he would never do that. The same dude that did it in the middle of the circus. Clowns do that because when you wear a mask, you're not expected to be you anymore. The social rules of who you're supposed to be go away because the mask is a symbol that I'm someone else. I don't have to behave like me. I could behave like Bozo, and that's okay. And you won't hold me accountable for how I behave now, because look, it's not me. And with that mask, think about this process carefully. With that mask, that clown is allowed to express his feelings exactly as he feels them, because he no longer is obligated to hide them for the sake of following the social rules. You see how that works? When the mask is on, I could be who I truly am on the inside, because I don't have to hide who I am in order to conform, in order to play the part of confident, upstanding guy who never falls down in public. Huh. Hold that thought. We're almost at the stop that we need to get to. Wine. Interesting one, right? What does wine do? We could say alcohol, but really this holiday is about wine, not alcohol in general. Wine famously removes the filter. Right? Would you agree with that? Yeah?
Looks like. Not from personal experience. From observation.
Or it makes you fall asleep.
Or sick.
Sick, right. If you have an allergic reaction to wine, or you just have a bellyache or something, wine can do that too. But, at least in the way that alcohol impacts people who don't get sick from wine, is that it, in some way, which is strange and even somewhat magical if you think about it, if there's a food or a drink out there that when you drink it, you say what you're thinking. Doesn't happen with hamburgers or orange juice, but if you drink that, you somehow can't stop yourself from saying how you really feel about people, for better or for worse. It's a filter removal. What is our filter? Our filter is the thing inside of us that helps us decide what to do or what not to do, what to say or what not to say, who to be or who I shouldn't be at any given moment. It's that thing that helps us nail the interview. I'm filtering out the parts of me that I don't want this person to see or know about. I only want them to see this part so that they'll think I'm this and not that and give me the job or give this person the job. We'll worry about that part later. Wine plus an interview is bad news, because then you'll show up and say, wow, this place seems terrible, right? Everything that you might be feeling, I don't really want this job, but my parents will still need to get a job. Things like that will come out, and then we won't be able to get on with what we want to do.
Well, they say to be yourself, so lying will help you be yourself.
That is true, but they're lying. Don't be yourself. No one ever wants to hire yourself. No, I'm just kidding. I wouldn't hire me. I would hire the best version of me, but nothing. We have famous lines in Tanakh, Nichnas Yayin Yetzasod. Wine comes in, secrets come out. Secrets, meaning things we feel but don't say, things we know but don't want to tell people, because we're deciding it would be bad for me to tell people that I know this or that this happened. And yet, once you have wine, that filter that says, what should I say, what shouldn't I say, goes away. There's a very fascinating Gemara in Erevin, one that you may have come across, that says, Adam nikar begimel dvarim. Person is recognized or identified by three things. Bekoso, bekiso, ubekaso. Have you ever heard of this? His cup, his wallet, and his anger. Those are three things that you want to get to really know a person. Get to know them when they've had a couple of drinks. Understand what they spend their money on, how they are with their money, which means where are their priorities. What do I spend more on? What do I not care about, spend less on? That's how you know a person. And Picasso, what they do when they're angry, or how they control their anger. Which means you want to know who a person really is, give them a couple drinks. There's some thing about when we drink that we get to the essence of who we are. Do you see the connection already? Because we're no longer filtering our behavior. We're no longer playing a role. We're no longer adapting to the social rules of who we're supposed to be in any given moment. And instead, we're simply stream of consciousness. This is who I am. So what are we trying to really do on Purim? Is the point to get as hammered as possible so you could forget everything ad lo yada, and so that you could have partied as much as you can because it's a celebration and let's just go for it? It can't be. It doesn't make any sense. What we're trying to do is to create a break from our normal life. A worldwide break from reality. To literally manufacture a scenario where I don't have to follow the rules that I normally have to follow in the world. Rules that say I can't hug you if I don't know you yet. Rules that say it's weird to smile at a stranger or to help them if I've never met them or I have other things to do. Rules that say I can't fully express how I feel. Do you ever notice what it means to be cool? I know we're going a lot, we're retreating back to high school a lot here, but it's important because there's a reason, because high school is all about this social thing. What is the cool kid doing in every scenario? Removing smoking. What is the cool kid doing? I'll give you one scenario, famous one, guys high school, maybe girls also. There's a chagiga. Go. What is the cool kid doing?
Sitting
on the side. Thank you. The cool kid is not getting involved. The cool kid is too cool for that stuff. What is cool? It's basically, I don't show you that I care about anything. I am removed. I don't have to express my emotions anyway. It's actually less cool if I get really excited about something. That means I'm not cool. There is this resistance socially. Society plays this role in subduing how we really feel. It's just not okay to be loud and animated. Go to a New York subway, the people that are overly animated are what we like to call in society's terms, crazy people, right? What you're supposed to do is keep quiet, keep to yourself, don't bump into anyone, don't make eye contact, and get on with your life. And the ones that don't do that are crazy. Or they're smarty. They get it somehow. That was a compliment to them, by the way. They get it. What we're trying to do on Purim is for one day a year, achieve a state of being the real me. something that we can't possibly do any other day of the year, when we have to be ourselves, when it's not socially acceptable to be the most purest form of me, because I have to follow rules. I have to choose who to be. And if I ignore that, then I'm the weirdo. Then I'm the one that's getting weird looks. I get to fully break down the barrier between my inner world and my outer world. If I love people, I could give to them. I could show them. I could go out of my way. If I want to say something, I say it. I don't have to filter it. I don't have to modify who I am. It's incredibly empowering, and it's not recommended any other day of the year. And there's a reason. Because we need a world where we're choosing. This is the opposite of the every other day of the year, where God says, you're here in order to make the right choices. That's why I gave you a seichel. That's why I gave you da'at. This day of year, it's time to get back in touch with who you really are. Forget the choices. Get in touch with your essence. Now, what does it mean to get in touch with who you really are and be, and give yourself permission to express who you really are, unfiltered? It is the purest form of happiness. Happiness being, as you and I both defined it, when our inner and outer worlds are aligned. And when we think of that as the possessions or our dreams or aspirations and those aligning, fine. But what about starting from the inside? When I feel a certain way and I'm not able to express it, and I'm not able to bring that out, that's where that detachment happens. And it happens on a daily basis, all day, every day. We do it on purpose. We need to, in order to survive in society. But for one day a year, I could feel truly myself. I could completely, fluidly exist on the inside and the outside, achieving complete unity, so to speak, with my inner world and outer world. That is the gift that exists on Purim. And in order to do that, you need to put on a mask so that you don't have to abide by the rules of who people expect you to be. You could be someone else, and that's okay. You have some l'chaims, which, by the way, is really only meant to enhance your ability to live unfiltered for a day. It's not necessary, but it's certainly difficult to do so without it. But anyone can, if they get to that place. And we do things like give presents to strangers. I don't know if you know this, but Mishloach Manot was never meant for our friends. That's not the point. You give things to your friends all the time. Mishloach Manot was meant to find a stranger, someone you've never met before. It could be a neighbor, it could be someone in a different city, and send them something. Because if everyone did that, think about what kind of effect it would have on the overall Jewish community. It would bring everyone together. There would be this sense of love which exists in the deepest part of who we are that finally gets to express itself. And you'll see it in incredibly drunk people who give free hugs to everyone, including inanimate objects, on Purim, because they allow themselves to express this love that they feel that society doesn't allow them to express, and even halacha doesn't allow them to express. But on Purim they can. All of these elements of Purim are not meant to party. Yes, there's a celebration. That is kind of the point. But what it's doing on a human level is constructing a reality where we can, for one day a year, find out who we really are and embrace it and be okay with it and not have to deny it or change it for someone else. What do we do on Yom Kippur? We come clean. We spend our whole year trying to be good, slipping up here and there, trying as hard as we can. And then we get to Yom Kippur, and we strip that all away, and we finally become the honest, realist version of who we really are. We don't play the game anymore, right? We say, I know, I'm sorry, I'm just trying, this is who I am. Any of us who have encountered a Yom Kippur and have gotten to that place where we ripped our hearts open and allowed ourselves to be vulnerable in front of God knows that feeling of coming clean. And there's a reason why the Gemara calls Yom Kippur the happiest day of the year. Think about that for a second. Why is it the happiest day of the year? Perhaps, I suggest, it is because it is that day of the year where you encounter the real you, where you're not playing any games. And that experience of being you, and not needing to be a version of you or trying to be another side of you, but just existing as you, is the most liberating feeling that you just never get to have any other day. Now you see the intimate connection between Purim and Yom Kippur. 2 days a year where you get to be you. Where you don't have to follow the rules because the rules are suspended for this day. And when you leave Yom Kippur having done that properly, there is a feeling of lightness. Not just because, according to halacha, we've been forgiven, if we did it right, that we could feel good, go home because God forgave you. But I actually didn't have to play a part today. I could just be me. I didn't have to hide parts of me. I didn't have to feel guilty about who I am. I could just be me. That is the happiness that we experience in Yom Kippur. But we do that on Yom Kippur by denying the world that we're in, by escaping it. We literally remove ourselves from reality. We lock ourselves in a room, whether it's our living room with our kids or our shul. And we spend the whole day not doing anything related to our lives. We're literally like angels. And then we try and reintegrate into normal life having done that. Now, what's Purim? Purim is skipping that step. Purim is living the true, unfiltered, real version of us in our world, in our life. I don't have to leave it. I don't have to escape it. I could actually be me in my world. It's what we're meant to be, in a way. Myself, in the world that I live in. And that's why Purim can be thought of as on a higher level than Yom Kippur. It's that same goal that we're after, of achieving complete awareness or embracing who we are without having to escape the world that we're in, by doing it inside our world. That's why the Gemara says in Shabbos that when we received the Torah at Har Sinai, God held the mountain over our heads. You may have heard this Gemara. Kafa Leim Har Kikigis. God held the mountain over our heads, and he said, if you accept the Torah, great, and if not, Shem Teik V'Raskam, I'll drop the mountain on you. And then later on, in the Yimei Achashverosh, the time of Purim, we re-accepted the Torah out of love. As the Pasuk in the Megillah says, Kimu V'Kiblu, Kimu Masha Kiblu Kfar. What does it mean to accept something out of fear? It means, on the outside, I accept what you're telling me to do, but on the inside, I don't. That's what fear is. I'll do what you say on the outside. You can't force me to love what you're telling me on the inside. What is accepting the Torah out of love? complete symmetry. You're giving me the Torah, and that's exactly what I wanted. It's achieving that level of unity between my outer and inner world. That is what love is. Same idea. What is V'nafohu about? V'nafohu being that the world that we've been existing in, we thought these are the rules. This is what it is. This is reality. The reality is I have to be like this in order to get what I want. I have to change myself in order to please that. I have to find a version of myself that will work so that these people, this situation, this environment will validate who I am. But not because that's who I really am, because that's who I need to be. And that's the world we live in. That's what we think. What does the Purim story come and teach us? This isn't reality, what you call reality. This is the play. This is the game that we're all playing. What's real is the opposite of this. When no one is playing any sort of game, when you're actually being who you are, when you're connecting to what really exists, not the rules of any foreign king, not the rules of any society or any clique or any community or anything that's different than from who you need to be, who you want to be, but the actual rules, what's real to you. And when the Jews realized back in Shushan, it's not Achashverosh running this. It's not Haman that gets to decide because he has a ring if we're going to live or going to die. That's silly. That's the game that we're playing here. The real rules is that there's a God. The real rules is if I am true to myself, that's when I am saved. That's when I am able to exist on a level beyond all of this. Not if I follow the rules of society, of kings, of dictators, of evil people. It's the day where we realize the opposite of what we do all year round is actually more real than every other day of the year. On one last note, so I work in the evenings as a therapist, clinical therapist. I see all sorts of different clients. There are a lot of Bar Ilan students I come into contact with, married young couples, single people, all sorts of people. Every story is different. And yet, there is often a theme that emerges. A theme that has nothing to do with any particular story or life circumstance. Teenagers who suffered abuse at home, married couples who are struggling with their relationship, and everything in between. That at the very core of many people's problems is that somewhere along the line, they were made to feel like the person that they are is not okay. That it's not acceptable to be them. A client who unfortunately described being abused, physically abused by her mother for years, for things like you didn't clean up your room, just terrible things that I don't even want to go into detail about. If that happens for you for long enough, you begin to form this understanding based on that, that it's not okay for me to be me, because if it was okay, no one would be hitting me just for being me. And that person's world now is defined by searching for the version of themselves that other people will find okay. Because there's no way in that person's mind that who they are right now is okay. And that is an extreme example. And yet it is something that we all struggle with on one level or another. But there are parts of me that are not okay. That it's, I don't have permission to be fully me. And sometimes that's our own voice saying that. It may be based on experiences that we've had or encounters or relationships. But it's something that we all struggle with, and when taken to an extreme, it can totally alter and ruin our ability to thrive in our world. It's a weight. I have to walk around constantly modifying who I am, constantly finding a different version of me, because me is not okay. Consider the opportunity that Purim presents to us, both people that don't suffer from any specific inner issue and people that are seemingly perfectly fine. The opportunity that it presents to us to say, I am okay being me. I love me. Me is great. I am enough. I am amazing. I am exactly who I'm supposed to be right now. That is the secret of Purim, of finding that voice, of settling all of those other perceptions, opinions, getting rid of them for just a day and saying, I'm okay being who I am. In a sense, Yom Kippur is when we're being judged for who we are. And we have to come to terms with the fact that there are parts of who we are that are not okay. And that's what we're here for. If we were fully okay, then we wouldn't be judged like this. Purim, on a higher level, not on a level of din, but on a level of rachamim, on a level of ahava, is saying, stop judging. We're throwing out the jury. We're throwing out your case. All love. Stop nitpicking. Stop trying to figure out what's wrong with you. You're good. You're good in my book. That's what God was saying to us. And that's the opportunity that we have on Purim to say to ourselves. For me, this idea changed my life. It allowed me to understand that there's a day where I can just fully connect with who I am. And even more so, it allowed me to realize how much or how little that actually happens over the course of even years of my life, where I don't fully embrace myself, I don't fully appreciate who I am or validate who I am or give myself love, enough love for who I am. We do a lot of self-criticism, way more than when we should. And this day is a day to throw out all the critics, to connect to who we are. Now the bad news is, most people that we'll run into do not know this secret about Purim. And they'll still go about it getting hammered at 10 in the morning. Or any variation of, or not, or just getting through Purim. Whatever version of it, I know I'm only going to one extreme. There are others that simply have a meal and that's it. But now that we know, we can't unknow it. Now that we know what opportunity we have on Purim, We have a chance. Again, alcohol optional. The mitzvah is only to drink a little more than you normally do. So if half a cup is normal, then 3/4 of a cup and you did the mitzvah. That's not the point. I'm not advocating getting drunk. But it's an opportunity to fully embrace who we are on this day when you look around and no one's caring about the rules. Where you could put on a mask and you could hug whoever you want within the boundaries of halacha, and you could fully embrace who you are, what's inside of you, what you like about you, and you don't have to judge anymore, you or anyone else. I hope we can take this opportunity, this Purim, I give us a bracha that we do, to fully encounter ourselves and embrace who we are 1,000%. And hopefully take that with us back into reality a day later, a year later, a lifetime later, and use it to enrich our lives and become the best versions of ourself, which is the realest version of ourself that we can. Thank you. Thank you.